Hi, everybody. Welcome to another Haas Talks Foss. I'm the Haas, head of open source strategy here at Percona, Matt Yakovit. And today I am joined by David Murphy. David, what's up?
I'm getting to travel again. I get to go to Percona Live. I'm excited by that because I actually get to leave Ireland.
Yeah. Ireland has had some weird lockdowns, right? Like, so it ebbs and flows where it's like, you're not allowed to leave, you're not allowed to come in. And so it's been a little more rigid, I think, than some of the other places.
Yeah, I think they've had some pretty strict lockdowns, but as a result of those lockdowns, we've really compressed the impact on the emergency departments and stuff. And so I think right now there were something like 400 cases in the whole island, not in the whole island, in the Republic of Ireland right now. They only recorded 400 cases or something like that yesterday.
No.
And so obviously they're doing something right, because now we don't have masks and all of that kind of stuff. We can go to cinemas and restaurants and all of that fairly normally. But I think next month will be the first time I actually go beyond like a quick flight in Europe, but actually go transatlantic.
Now, that should be, you know, good, because I mean, you were living in Texas for a really long time. So being able to see, yeah, you know, people that you know and, you know, visit family and friends, it's always a good trip back home to just visit folks.
Yeah. And that was why when y'all decided it was going to be in Austin again, I was like, great. That's two birds, one stone right there.
Oh, yeah. Now, for those of you who don't know David, we've done a podcast before. So, you know, it was like really early on. So the quality might not be up to snuff where we are today, because now we're like on episode like 70. So we've gotten quite a few folks who have come through the doors here. But it's always good to catch up and see what's new and exciting in David's world. So, David, what are you doing now? What sort of things are you working on?
So I'm working in the same kind of consulting area that I was before the last time we talked. But where I was taking Oracle and modernizing that and bringing it to the cloud and doing a lot of infrastructure as code and stuff like that, I've now moved everything Mongo into the cloud for the company. And now I'm looking at MSSQL and MySQL stuff as well. So that's a whole different beast when you start worrying about Windows stuff. And so I've started looking more at how do I solve certain RDS problems with AWS endpoints, which we can talk about in a little more depth here in a minute. I think that's an interesting area of challenge, but it can be solved kind of problem. And then I've also been looking at the new RDS custom stuff. I don't know if you've been watching that at all.
No, I haven't.
And so RDS custom is a really interesting thing AWS has started doing. So as you know, RDS, it's a managed service database, can't really do a lot, have very limited disk access to even export a file, import a file kind of stuff. RDS custom is for MSSQL, Oracle. I can't remember if there's a Postgres one as well. But what it lets you do is you take more control of that stack from AWS, and so you can manage your HA instead of them managing it for you. And so now we can start thinking about proxy SQL and other tools in that same kind of vein that used to be off limits or a bit disconnected for what you want to do. Also things like Redmine and stuff like that might become easier to use, because you can have local agents on the boxes rather than hope that AWS added agent support for OEM or whatnot that you needed. And so that's a very exciting area for me right now. And then also I'm venturing a lot more into database as code as opposed to infrastructure as code areas. And so this is more schema as code. How do we manage versions? How do I hook those into application versions? How do I start getting people to start using deployment users versus runtime users so that we limit the database access if an application got infected in some way? How do we keep them from dropping a database table, aka they came in through some sort of hostage taking thing, but they can't actually drop a MySQL table or drop a Mongo table because they only have access to create, insert, or delete?
So are you looking at tools for databases code?
So I started looking at Liquidbase and a few tools like that. I have been a bit disappointed with the open source options of that field right now. the open source options, while there's a few good ones for a specific tech, you don't get a lot of multi-tech support currently. And so Liquibase does some stuff, but obviously, as you move up their stack, you need to start going and paying them for some of the more security-centric or team-centric type features. So that's not great. But I'm hoping that as more teams are evolving into the SRE and DBRE space, we're going to start seeing more and more of those tools crop up.
Yeah. And, you know, not to do a plug, but, you know, Robert Reeves, who's a CTO over at Liquibase, is going to be at Percona Live talking about Liquibase. And that could be an interesting conversation, fly on the wall type thing, to see what sort of things that the community might need out of those in the open source space versus what's in their paid offering. Always interesting to have conversations around that.
That could be interesting, even just in the expo hall, if we could get maybe a group of us that are from companies like that, but also users that are consulting with big companies to say, hey, these are the challenges I'm trying to solve. What is your thought on where the community is going, as opposed to where your company specific is going?
Well, what's interesting is I've actually got a podcast and live stream booth for guests to come in, and we can invite guests. So, you know, maybe I'll have you and Robert and a couple other folks swing on by. We can all chat live on, you know, like, you know, deploying schemas as code, and that could be interesting. Yeah. You know, that could be a fun time. But, it's an interesting space, because you are right. When we talk about the evolution, we talked about this a year ago, and I've not seen it slow down, which is the evolution of everything as code, everything trying to move away from the operational side of things. You know, you mentioned RDS, you mentioned, you know, you're going to be talking about Terraform. There's so many different tools that are focused on the operation side. It leaves the kind of design, development, and architecture side a little bare right now. And I think that's where the next generation of tools, the next generation of innovation needs to come, right, from that area.
Yeah, I would say, if I had to break it down, where we've seen the most maturity in open source, especially in like the Ansible and Terraform kind of landscape, is all on building that piece of infrastructure, whether it's RDS, whether it's an EC2 node. But then when we start talking about the Ansible layer or the user data or the cloud init layer, whatever tool, salts, whatever tool you're using there, there's not a lot of cohesive tool chains there for how do I go from I have a base OS to I've installed my SQL to I've installed my users that I need for my team to I've installed the application users to the application schemas to any stored procedures, blah, blah. There's not a big tool chain on that, regardless of which database tech we're talking about. And I've honestly built a whole bunch of that. I think there's probably a good 6,000 lines of Ansible code in the Oracle modules that we've written for Ansible and that we're doing, because me and my team, we've broken up everything to where everything's templated and modular. And so like I can just slide around new things very quickly. I can drop a new SQL file in a folder and it knows what template it's in because of the name of the folder. And so when that template is called, that file is called, and because of the name of that file, it knows what order to do it in. Obviously that's good to a certain point, but then Liquibase is what kind of takes me past that point into, well, how do I worry about how these files are changing?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I think that, you know, just beyond even like the structures, you know, I think that there's a component there that we're not there yet. Because, you know, when we talk about schema migrations have long been a problem across multiple, you know, programming languages, applications, databases, you know, just keeping those in sync is an issue. But I think there's even a deeper, more ethereal, you know, issue at heart, which is, and I like to call it the apathy of developers when it comes to anything database related or data related. And I think that I have seen less skill set in the data architecture side, you know, less thought process into how the structures look, how they interact, and how data is pulled out and used. it's more of, I want it to just be a black box where I dump things in and something happens behind the scenes.
That is absolutely a big problem right now, is because we've extracted out that kind of check and balance that might have used to exist in by having DevOps. What you have is a whole bunch of engineers that are very good at building LAMP stacks or Java stacks or whatnot that they're doing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But then to them, the database is still a black box. They don't want to get involved in it. And to be fair, I think Azure and AWS and Google have made this problem worse, because RDS is so easy for them to run a simple little Terraform module that just builds an RDS, five lines of code. They don't have to think about it, and they start pumping data into it. They're not thinking about, what is my index structure? What is my schema structure? What am I trying to achieve with this database long term? And then when it is falling apart, they come to the DBA team or DBRE team and expect us to wave a magical wand and the problem will just go away. And like I have in my main customer, in their one biggest Mongo replica set, they have 52 apps involved in that. And they're a microservice strategy. And I'm like, well, is it microservice if you have a single dependent core database instead of one database per application, or one data store per application, that is feeding each of those microservices? And then the management and the leaders and the architects, software architects, when I bring that up that way, they're like, oh yeah, this is really bad. And I was like, it's like, involve us in these conversations, we'll help you. But
well, what's funny though is you have the opposite as well, right? Where now I've seen some microservices require 3-4 databases, and then there's 1,000 of them, and then all of a sudden you've got 2,000, 3,000 databases out there. And it's like, now you've got like this large environment, which, great if you've got the tools to manage that environment and you can make it effective. But then everybody comes back and says, oh crap, now I need data from all like 1,000 in one place. And then they go, oh, let's create a data lake. Oh, that's what we need. And then like all of a sudden, like you just start like bolting on more stuff, and it makes it way more complicated. Right?
Yeah, I think the secret sauce there is, like, in my AWS accounts, I have a non-prod account, I have a prod account, I have a shared account. And then at an AWS as a whole, I have a shared account, and then there's an app prod and app non-prod account. And it's very loosely translated. That's how we have things set up. But the idea behind that is we have, oh, and there's a DevOps tools account. And so the idea behind that is, it's not hard to have some sort of reference data central system that multiple different microservices might use. But what they're using is that microservice, not that central DB. Mm-hmm. And that's the big difference, is because then they can still have their circuit breaker pattern on hitting that API and have some default behaviors if they can't find a piece of reference data, and to where they can still operate if ref data was off for 5 minutes because it was patched or whatever. Okay. But most companies, I think you're right, they either aren't doing enough in microservice separation land, or they're doing way too much and they're not thinking about central services that still should exist to empower everything else. Because, for example, if we're talking about some sort of ticketing system, the ticketing system that understands where seats are in an orchestra, that doesn't need to necessarily be running so that you can order a ticket. You just need to be able to know what ticket ID or seat number you needed. You don't actually need to be able to display the map. And so, like, breaking some of those connections is where a lot of people fall down, because they think, oh, well, I need this. But you know as well as me, Matt, that seat map probably could have been in Redis and as a write through cache, so that if anything changed in that seat map, the database still had it, but Redis had it in case the database was offline.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think it's that architecture design side of things. People are moving so fast now, it's just crazy. It's like, you know, we have an insatiable need to get code out as quickly as possible without thinking. And I think, you know, you mentioned RDS, Aurora, Azure, making it so easy, it kind of hurts everybody else. I've been, you know, bringing that up for a while now as a big potential issue. So, I mean, I definitely see those problems kind of becoming worse.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I've also had certain conversations with Amazon at different times because, like, for example, their Document DB service, Percona server has LDAP support, has dynamic users based on my directory structure and stuff. Document DB doesn't have that. And so that, like, how many times did some engineer decide to use Document DB or RDS because it was easy, but then it trips over itself on some very fundamental security thing that you would have expected a different design pattern to go in to manage those users. And now you're trying to bolt on a solution instead.
Yeah. But I mean, I think this is classic. A lot of people call it code debt. I don't even think it's tech debt or code debt here. It's something that works doesn't necessarily mean it's correct.
Absolutely. Right? And I wouldn't call that tech debt because tech debt, if you're doing it right, tech debt is an intentional decision to delay changing something or fixing something because it's not worth the cost now. It's worth doing in 6 months. Whereas what you're talking about there is unintentional debt.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's funny, you know, and I've used this example before. You can have something that works perfectly well for years until you hit some inflection point. I had a plumbing issue where I bought this house. It's brand new. No issues. It turned out that they didn't install the plumbing correctly. Yes. And underneath the floorboards, there was an issue. And until it reached a certain point where it started to, like, you know, cause issues in the floorboards, I couldn't do any. I didn't even know that it existed. And for multiple years, the plumbing was fine. And then all of a sudden, one day it wasn't. And it was like a huge repair. And I think that's what you have in this case.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny you use plumbing as an example. I bought a new house just a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. And in one of the sink drains, they had cracked one of the fittings. Nobody noticed.
Right.
Simple accident. But until I accidentally left the water just trickling when I went to a wedding for 3 days, I had no idea it was a thing. I come home and the entire living room, like the smoke alarm, has water trickling out of it. Ooh. Because it's just, it was enough that it eventually got past that level of the trap and just started filling up my ceiling. But it's the same kind of thing is those little drip effects, whether we're talking tech or we're talking plumbing, they add up. And people forget that lots of small things add up. That's exactly why we're talking about the microservice problem. Because if you have 100 microservices, that pain of having all those separate ones was annoying, but not bad. When you have 1,000 of them, that's significantly worse. When you have 10,000 microservices, forget it. You have to go re-architect. There's no way you're going to manage that.
Yeah. And I think that the further you go along, the more difficult it becomes, especially considering now the average tenure for people at a tech job is less than 2 years, which means that by the time that, you know, trickle problem occurs, the person who wrote it probably isn't there. And the people who are there are going to be like, WTF, right? Like, what the hell is this? You know, like, I think that's a common occurrence.
Well, and I think there's also some atrophy that occurs there is when we run into these situations, you are going WTF, but then you're also going, but why?
Yeah.
Why did they do it this way? There's got to be a reason I'm not seeing, but you don't have that person to ask anymore. And so I do think that's a big challenge. I think that's why companies are pushing so much on infrastructure as code, though, because at least at that point, once infrastructure as code, it is codified that decision was made at this time and you have a GitHub history and you can kind of try to suss out what might be happening. And if you've done it well, you have a link to some Jira ticket or whatever your ticketing system of choice is that gives you an idea on, okay, they did this commit for these reasons. Let me try to reverse engineer just this part of it rather than my whole application. And so I think that's where that trend is coming from. But I think a lot of people underestimate how expensive infrastructure as code is, because somebody could do something in 2 minutes by hand they might need a week to codify it and get it done right in infrastructure as code.
And let's be honest, infrastructure as code is great if you do it right, but if you do it wrong, it just turns one problem into several.
Or it creates a much bigger cascade, let's delete everything problem.
Yes. I mean, you look at a lot of major outages issues, and it does come back to, you know, hey, we had this configuration change. It automated through 1,000 machines, and oops, we got that change wrong.
Yeah. I mean, I've had some of that where we've instituted some Terraform Verify type checks in Jenkins and stuff to help us. And like one of the guys came to me and goes, hey, David, your Mongo instances, they have this thing. And I'm like, why does my Terraform say I have missing variables all of a sudden? Who changed my modules? What's going on? Now, because like none of the Mongos had been rebuilt. So obviously somebody made a change. They merged to master. It hadn't rolled out with anything. But whoever was going to do Mongo next was going to feel the pain when their release got delayed because they went to go rebuild an environment and it did not play nice.
Yeah. I hear you. Well, since the last time that you have been on the show, I've instituted kind of a rapid fire round to our conversations. I find that this is an interesting way to kind of, you know, end the discussions and conversations. And I figured now would be a good time for us to go to the rapid fire round where I'm just going to ask you random questions on the top of my head that I've asked other people, or maybe you haven't asked anybody. Okay. And so let's go and see how this works. It's worked out pretty well for other folks, but it is interesting. So I am curious, as you look at the tech landscape now, what is the technology that you are most interested in learning or figuring out?
Ooh. I want to say the Snowflake kind of data warehousing 3.0 space is definitely something I want to spend some more time with, because it's flipping on its head a lot of the preset ideas around data lakes and data warehouses and how we should manage that data.
Hmm. Okay. And you probably have a lot of data that you're managing right now, so it probably makes sense to start thinking about that.
Yeah. I mean, I work with an airline. Imagine all the data an airline has to keep and have access to, from payroll to fuel to who's flown when to, you know, fraud to, you know, all of these things that they have to know, they have to be able to attribute that data. But one central data warehouse is probably a really bad idea because that's a nice honeypot for somebody.
Yeah. So worst technology you've ever worked with and you want to tell everyone to avoid?
I have to say, and I'm going to get a lot of haters for this, I do not like working with Ruby.
Okay. Fair enough. Hey, like, you know, some people like it, some people don't. I mean, what is your favorite programming language? If you're going to go write something today, what are you going to write it in?
I'm going to default to Python, and then I'm going to go to Golang if I need to have a lot of multi-processing or kind of child parent subscriber kind of model stuff going on. Depending on the amount of thread concurrency I need, I might need to leave Python, because Python's great, but Python is I would say Python is my go-to tool building language, and Golang is my performance computing language.
Okay, fair enough. And so what was the last book you read?
So are we talking technical book or
any book, okay. Technical, non-technical.
What was it called? I think it was called The End of Witches, which was a really interesting history of North Atlantic witch history in the United States, and the religious undertones and how different starvation and food shortages and stuff like that played into that. And it was about a family that were not witches, but how they got ostracized by their community because they needed somebody to hate.
Okay.
And so that was really interesting. Technical-wise, I'm wanting to dive into the new Postgres cookbook that just came out not too long ago. Or did it? Is it about to come out? I can't remember the exact date. That's probably the next one I'm going to grab at a technical level.
Okay. Okay. And what sort of television show are you watching and partaking in now? Are you a fan of the Moon Knight? Are you a fan of the Halo series or any of those?
I haven't actually watched either of those yet. I went on a witch kick lately. I don't know why. I read a book on witches, and then there was this other show that I came across. It's got two seasons in it. It was on Prime. It was called Motherland.
I think I've seen a couple episodes of that.
And the premise is really interesting because it's modern day. But what happened is in the early days of America kind of time frame, colonial time, witches were brought into the army as another division of the army in all the countries around the world. And this is about witches in the military and kind of the family names that build up in military families and all of that kind of stuff going on with a magic witches background story going on. Very interesting. It also has some very strong humans that are very anti-witch protesting and stuff like that. And so it has some very interesting dynamics going on. But that was an interesting one. I binged all of that. But the one that I keep going back to and rewatching right now is Picard season 2, because I'm really liking Picard season 2.
Have not gotten to it. Have not. It's on my list. I'm trying to keep up with everything, but there's so many good TV shows.
Yeah. I would say this about Picard for you, without giving you any spoilers. It's got Picard. It's got Borg. It's got Q.
Yeah, I've seen the previews, and the problem with all these streaming sites is that there's two minds of people, right? Which is, one is we're going to release it every week, or we're just going to release them all. I prefer release them all so I can just watch them all, right? Mm-hmm. And so I know Picard is one that is a drop weekly. Moon Knight, which I'm still really confused by, is a drop weekly as well. And same thing with Halo. But it's kind of hard to like sit down and be like, okay, I want to watch this. You watch it, and then like you have to wait another week. I'm like, man, I'm so over that. Netflix has ruined me forever for binge watching.
Did you ever watch the whole Expanse series?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Yes. Because that's a good one. If you hadn't seen that one, that's a really great sci-fi opera kind of.
Yeah, no, it's that's a really good one, and I really got into that as well. Kind of sad when that ended. You invest so much into these shows, and then all of a sudden, like, they end.
Yeah, but on the flip side, there are like I think three more books in that series. So anybody who watched The Expanse that likes it should pick up those books and read what happens after, because there is more.
Well, and I think the books and the shows do diverge in a few places that are,
you have to look up. But I think as far as the timeline goes, the books and Expanse were pretty good about keeping a certain pace until that last season, which blew forward quite fast. And so, it depends, because some stuff, it's nothing like the source material. Other stuff, they try to be a little truer.
Yeah. All right, David, thank you for coming out and hanging out with us today, chatting with us a little little sci-fi at the end there. All fun stuff. Great catching up with you, and hope to see you and we'll see you in a couple weeks at Percona Live.
Yep. I'll see you then. Be great to chat with everybody again.
All right. And for those who are listening, watching this video, please subscribe, give us comments, give us feedback. Tell, David that you disagree with his Ruby reference. It's okay. We want to hear from you. Feel free to put comments in the links below. So until next time, we'll see you later. Wow, what a great episode that was. We really appreciate you coming and checking it out. We hope that you love open source as much as we do. If you like this video, go ahead and subscribe to us on the YouTube channel. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. And of course, tune in to next week's episode. We really appreciate you coming and talking open source with us.